Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Edgar Degas, 1834 to 1917, is celebrated as the painter of dancers, a subject that dominated his art for nearly four decades. An exuberant display of rich imagination and keen observation, his renowned images of the Paris Opera are among the most sophisticated and visually compelling works he created. Celebrating the 350th anniversary of the Opera's foundation, Degas at the Opera presents approximately 100 of the artist's best-known and beloved works in a range of media, including paintings, pastels, drawings, prints, and sculpture. Organized with the Musée d'Orsay et de l'Orangerie, Paris, the exhibition is on view at the National Gallery of Art from March 1st through July 5th, 2020. On opening day, curator Kimberly Jones shares insights on the exhibition, the first to explore Degas' enduring fascination with the opera.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the National Gallery of Art. I'm Kimberly Jones, curator of 19th century French paintings, and the curator of the exhibition that just opened this past week, Degas at the Opera, which of course is what has brought us all here today. Now, when you think of the name of Edgar Degas, your mind immediately is transported to ballerinas. He is the greatest painter of the dance. But what people don't always understand is Degas' engagement with the dance was only a small part of a much larger story. It really is something that's embedded in the history, the culture, and the world of the Paris Opera. This exhibition, which was organized in conjunction with the Musée d'Orsay in Paris, where it was held this past fall, was organized in celebration of the 350th anniversary of the founding of the Paris Opera. A pretty significant event, one might say. And now it, of course, has come here to Washington, where it will be on view for the next 4 months. For Degas, the world of the opera was one that really became his greatest inspiration. This exhibition is the first to really explore what was a lifelong love affair between Edgar Degas and the world of the opera, its precincts, its inhabitants, its performances, its whole culture. Very much is fundamental to his art and would inspire not only his most beautiful and well-known art, but some of the most challenging, provocative, and experimental works of his entire career. Now, for Degas, that story begins at the Salle Le Peletier, the old opera house on the Rue Le Peletier, which was founded in 1821. It was meant to be actually a temporary opera house after the old opera house had been destroyed by fire. And it's there where Degas first experienced the opera as someone in attendance. It was a fairly sedate and rather severe-looking building, relatively speaking, to its successor, the Palais Garnier, the opera house, of course, we all know today. You just see by comparing them how relatively austere and simple the old opera house was. Even the name, the Salle Le Peletier, the Auditorium Peletier, and the Palais Garnier, which says so much. Now, tragically, the Salle Le Peletier was also destroyed by fire. This seems to be a trend. There's a lot of wood. It was destroyed in 1873. Happily, the new opera house was already under construction. There had been actually a nationwide competition among architects, and the competition was won by Charles Garnier in 1861. He began building this magnificent opera house. The Empress Eugénie, apparently, was not terribly happy about this. She wanted her favorite architect, Villiers-le-Duc, to win the competition, was quite put out when he didn't win. She apparently told Garnier, sort of rather haughtily, well, what style is this opera house? And he said, well, madame, it's style Napoleon III. Obviously, she could not be mad about an opera house that was inspired and named after her husband. So that helped to smooth over some ruffle feathers, but it is magnificent. Indeed, this opera house sort of became the gold standard for opera houses all through Europe. And for the next several decades, opera houses across Europe popped up very much in the style of Garnier's Grand Palace. It was a palace that was admired for the elegance and simplicity of its style. There was the front entrance, a wonderful grand staircase, and then, of course, the foyer, this large auditorium that could seat 2,000, and then all this back area. I just show you this just so you can see how much smaller and simpler the old opera house was compared to this very grandiose and exuberant opera house. I would also say Degas hated the new opera house. He thought it was too glitzy, too extravagant, too much. He did not like it at all. This is important. Keep this in mind, because this is a theme that will actually reappear in Degas' art. Now, when Degas does turn to the opera, we already come up across something very intriguing. Degas' approach is very unconventional, much like he himself. His first opera painting, and indeed also his first ballet picture, is this one, the portrait of Eugénie Fiocre, apropos of the ballet La Source. That was the title he gave it. It's a portrait of Mademoiselle Fiocre, apropos of the ballet La Source. It's a very strange title. And it's not one that necessarily screams ballet, even though it is inspired by the ballet La Source by composer Lia Delibes, which had just debuted in 1866 to considerable fanfare. But it's not the performance that Degas is most interested in, although he very meticulously reconstructs the stage setting. It was very grand. This is grand opera at its finest, with this wonderful stage setting meant to evoke the Caucasian mountains. There was apparently an actual stream on stage. A live horse came on stage. I mean, this is, you know, they were not messing around when they said grand opera. But what Degas was most interested in was the ballerina, Eugénie Fiocre, who you see seated here in the center. In fact, the only thing that even hints that you're looking at a ballet is this dainty little pair of ballet slippers tucked away between the horse's legs. He's not showing you a performance. He's showing you some indeterminate moment of repose, probably during a dress rehearsal. But it's Eugénie Fiocre that intrigued him. She was, in fact, one of the great rising stars of the Paris Ballet. She made her big breakout role in 1864, playing in a ballet known as Nemea, or Love Avenged. And she quickly rose to celebrity. She was admittedly renowned among her contemporaries more for her beauty than she necessarily was for her balletic talent. Nevertheless, she went on to have a very lengthy and successful career and actually married an aristocrat and had a very happy life. Degas, no doubt, was hoping to sort of cash in on her fame. He creates this very large portrait, which you will see in the first room of the show, very grandiose, very unconventional, featuring this very famous starlet. It is essentially a celebrity portrait, and he hoped that maybe between the combination of her celebrity and the rather unusual image that he produced, it would gather attention. Spoiler alert, it passed pretty much unnoticed. Only the critic Emile Zola actually acknowledged that it was quite beautiful. It was hung very high and no one could see it. So as an experiment, it didn't work, but it's important because it gives you sort of an insight into how Degas will approach ballet and opera, that he's not doing it in the most conventional way, just showing dancers arrayed across the stage. He's thinking very creatively about the experience of the opera. That is very much clear in sort of his next great painting of the Paris opera, the ballet from Robert le Diable. Robert le Diable by Giacomo Meyerbeer was an enormous success when it debuted in Paris in 1831. It was particularly famous for its scandalous ballet of the nuns in Act Three. In this scene, a group of damned nuns, nuns who had actually broken their vows, rise up from their graves and they dance ecstatically across the stage. It was very sexy and very shocking in 1831. By 1871, the opera had come to be seen as a little worn and old-fashioned, but that ballet was still interesting. That was surprisingly provocative by French standards. Degas, of course, greatly admired the ballet. He knew it quite well. I'm showing you actually, you see an exhibition. These are just two stage sets for that particular scene that intrigued Degas so much. But he also did a series of drawings of the nuns as they dance across the stage. And these are extraordinary, these brush and ink drawings, very immediate, very spontaneous. They give you a sense of the dynamism of the figures, sort of as they're moving and writhing across stage, which then Degas uses when he creates the painting. But when you look at the painting, you realize the ballet is literally just the background. It's not what the painting is actually about, despite the title. What we see instead is half the composition given over to the orchestra in the foreground, and most notably, this interesting gentleman who has his opera glasses trained not on the stage, but actually up into the boxes. He's watching the people. And this is something that's important to understand about Paris opera in the context of French society of the 19th century. Paris opera was largely seen as in something of a decline. There weren't a lot of new operas being performed, and the repertoire was pretty limited. And so the same operas were performed over and over again. And if you were a subscriber, you oftentimes didn't know until very shortly in advance what was being performed. So this poor guy may very well be seeing Romeo and Diablo for the 12th time. And spoiler alert, most people did not come for the opera. The hardcore fans did. They were coming for two things. They were coming to see and be seen, because this was basically celebrity sighting 101. Or they were coming for the ballet, to see the dancers. So again, keep this also in mind. Degas was a little different because he came for all of it. He wanted the whole package. That's what really excited him. Now, Degas' engagement with the opera is very much rooted in his love of music. He was deeply attached to music, very fond actually of 18th century music. His tastes are very old school. He loved Gluck. Gluck was his favorite. He loved Johann Sebastian Bach. He loved Mozart. Not so much contemporary music. And one of the places where he really got to enjoy that was in private homes. In the 19th century, in the days before cinema and television, you entertained yourself en famille, with your friends and family. And his father would host musical evenings in his home on every Monday night. And so he would bring in musicians, a combination of amateur and professional musicians, who would perform in these interior spaces for gathered friends and family. And Degas not only went to his father's, he attended others. For example, the painter Eugène Manet, his mother also hosted a musical soiree, and he would attend that, and he would see Manet, and he'd see Manet's sister-in-law, Berthe Morisot. And so this is how people experience music. And so here we have Degas sort of showing that in his art. On the left, we have actually what's the only portrait he ever painted of his father, Auguste Degas. And you see him sitting very meditatively, clearly deeply in thought, deeply engaged in the process of listening as this man, Lorenzo Pagans, is performing. And Lorenzo Pagans had actually, he was Spanish, and he started his career at the Paris Opera, didn't really take off there, and instead sort of transitioned into a new career as a music teacher and as a performer and composer. He became known as the Spanish singer. He would perform his folkloric songs from Spain, and also then created his own new compositions based on Spanish folklore music and would perform with a guitar. So again, it's a kind of very intimate, very personal experience of music in the home. And I should say that one of Degas' contemporaries in later years comments on how he visited Degas' home, and this painting hung over Degas' bed. So for the rest of his life, Degas associated the memory of his father with music. So again, it's something very personal, very intimate. Of a similar tone is this painting, The Song Rehearsal, a painting we believe was inspired by the time that Degas spent in New Orleans. Something a lot of people don't know is that Degas' mother was Creole, and he's the only Impressionist artist who ever traveled to America. He spent several months in New Orleans visiting with family in 1872. And in his letters back, he commented that the lack of opera was a genuine privation. He missed it so much. What he did have were those kinds of private, intimate performances in people's homes. This painting was probably not painted in New Orleans, but is very much an evocation of that experience. And we think, for example, the woman dressed in yellow may be Degas' sister Marguerite, who was known as having a very beautiful singing voice. Now, a very different kind of portrait is the orchestra of the opera. And at first glance, you wouldn't think of this as a portrait, and yet it was commissioned by the sitter Désiré Dio, who was the lead bassoonist at the Paris Opera. And you can see him right here, front and center. This is an extraordinary, I mean, talk about an unconventional approach to portraiture. Rather than showing him simply sitting in an interior, he shows him at work. And to do this, he makes some very interesting artistic choices. He basically rotates the orchestra around because their backs would be to us as the viewer. So instead, he shows them from the side. And then, of course, he sticks the bassoon right front and center, which, you know, spoiler alert, that is not where a bassoonist sits in an orchestra. Nevertheless, it is a wonderful, sort of whimsical portrait of his friend at work. And he's surrounded by other musicians. So we have here violoncellist Louis-Marie Pillet. You can see this portrait in the show. We have the flautist Altes, Achille Goffet, who is playing the double bassoon, who you can see all of these guys. There's Pillet,
there's Altes, there's Goffet, and there in the corner there's the composer Emmanuel Chabrier, just sort of hanging out, listening to the orchestra. Once again, he creates this very interesting sort of two-tiered composition. The front register is focusing on the musicians, the figures who are meant to be invisible. They perform, they provide the music, but we, the audience, aren't supposed to be looking at them and thinking about them. Our eyes should be trained up at the stage. And the stage, again, becomes just a background with this wonderful sort of cacophony of legs and colorful tutus in the background moving around, very much as a colorful backdrop. Now, also within this musical world, as I mentioned, Degas included not only professional composers, but also amateurs. This is important because Degas had a very lively musical circle. He was surrounded by friends who were themselves composers, musicians, dancers, singers. And so he was part of that world through them. They actually provided the entree. A fun fact I forgot to point out, Désiré Dieux is actually the first cousin of Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec. And it was through Dieux that Degas and Toulouse-Lautrec first met. So again, these fun, interesting facts of all these, how these people all sort of connect and how they know each other. So Degas was very plugged in to the music world of the 19th century. And so, for example, we have two wonderful portraits from the National Gallery's collection, which, because of restrictions, could not travel to Paris, but we're happy to show here. Madame Camus, Blanche Camus, was actually an amateur pianist, very talented, only performed at these private musical evenings. She apparently was quite adept at playing the fugues of Bach, which Degas and his father greatly admired. And then you have someone like Mademoiselle Malot. She's one of two sisters who were both ballet dancers at the Paris Opera, Thérèse and Augustine. We don't know which one she is. Images are not very helpful. But it's probably Thérèse, because Thérèse actually had a love affair with René Degas, who was Degas' younger brother. And some years later, after she had married, there was this infamous encounter between René Degas and Thérèse's husband outside the stock market. And René pulled a gun and shot at her husband, happily did not hit him, but he did spend 6 months in jail for his attempted homicide. So again, a lot of drama going on behind the scenes with these musical figures. Certainly one of the musical figures that Degas most admired was the soprano Rose Caron. She became celebrated for her basically creating the role of Brunhilde in Ernest Reyer's opera Siegout, an opera that probably no one today has ever heard of. You do know the source material very well through Richard Wagner, who used it as the inspiration for the whole the Ring cycle. But Rose Caron became celebrated soprano both in Paris and Brussels, and Degas was more than a little in love with her. He actually attended Siegout 37 times, that we know of, and he actually wrote a sonnet which he dedicated to her, and he called her the divine Madame Caron. And you can see her here pulling on a glove, showing off those beautiful arms that Degas so greatly admired. Now, of course, there's also the world within the opera itself, and that brings us squarely back to the Paris Opera Ballet. Now, there were multiple opera houses in Paris in the 19th century, just to be clear. Each one had its own specialization. The Théâtre des Italiens only performed Italian operas. The Opéra Comique performed more lighthearted fairs, fair operettas, and things that were considered a little less grand, shall we say. Probably the most famous opera performed there was Georges Bizet's Carmen, which, interestingly enough, now is probably the most famous opera in the world, or if not one of, but because it was a contemporary subject matter, that it was considered too low class for the Grand Paris Opera. But the Paris Opera had one thing no one else had. They had a ballet. And in the 19th century, ballet was an essential part of any opera. It wasn't just an add-on. It was very much at the heart. You could not perform an opera, a grand opera, without a ballet. So much so that when Richard Wagner was going to debut Tannhäuser in Paris in 1861, he was told he had to add in a ballet, and he was completely befuddled by this. He did not understand what was going on. You don't have opera, you don't stick a ballet in an opera, but he was told he had to do it, so he dutifully did so. Unfortunately, he put it right at the beginning of the opera, which of course was a terrible tactical mistake because so many people came late, because they expect the ballet later on. And so it ended up sort of being a complete disaster and a very hard lesson for Richard Wagner to learn. But the ballet was essential. It was so integral. And it's here that Degas finds a subject that really excites and challenges him. He does a whole series of images of dancers at rehearsal. And I've always believed that part of what Degas admired about the dance was he viewed them very much like they were artists. Not only artists, they were athletes. They trained and honed and refined their bodies. They were disciplined. They were controlled. They were creative. So he saw, I think, a little of himself in the dancers, in what they did. And that was one reason why he was so, I think, attracted to rehearsal scenes, because you see the dancers as they are becoming, as they are in process of creating their art. Degas, as an artist, was in many ways more interested in the creation of the art than in the final product. It was about getting there, what you learned along the way, more than the result. And so that's one reason, I think, why you see so many rehearsal paintings. Now, something to keep in mind in these rehearsal paintings is Degas is looking backwards and inwards. Many of these paintings were produced after 1873, after the old opera house had been destroyed by fire. And yet, he is showing you the rehearsal rooms of the old opera house, not the new opera house. And there's still a lot of question about how much access he actually had to the opera house at that time. He was not a subscriber. He did not have that annual subscription, which would allow him free access. He may, however, have been able to sort of sneak in on an occasion thanks to friends in his social circle, particularly Ludovic Halévy, who I'll be talking about a little bit later. But when you look at these paintings, interesting sort of things start to catch your attention. You see that there are many of the same elements. For example, this row of windows with the circular archway at the top, which is very distinctive of the old opera house. And yet, it's the same room, but why is there a colonnade here? And where did this staircase come from? And then you have the earlier paintings. Well, where did this come from? I mean, who would put a spiral staircase in the middle of a rehearsal room? Well, answer, nobody would. It wasn't there. There was, however, a spiral staircase in Degas' studio. So what is happening is he is hiring dancers, inviting them to come pose in his studio where he would produce studies. And then he uses them to create paintings. And these paintings are this interesting sort of amalgam of the reality of the dancers combined with memory and imagination. They are imaginary dreamscapes that he's creating. So no, there was no spiral staircase there. And yet, look at this painting. Doesn't it feel real? Doesn't it feel authentic? And that's where Degas' real genius lies. He is not replicating factual accuracy. He's not concerned about the details and the minutiae. What he's interested in is capturing that experience, that sort of visceral sense of truth and reality. This feels so real. And in fact, were you to put these paintings side by side with other contemporary images, even photographs, these are the ones that you would immediately, instinctively say, that's right, that's real. Because it feels like you're there. It feels like you've literally crossed the threshold and you're seeing all the little details, the dancer who's sort of, you know, chewing on her thumbnail, others who are performing, the ones who are clattering down the staircase, fixing their bodice, fixing their bow, scratching their back. It all these sort of elements that are so natural and normal and spontaneous. And he brings them all together to create them something that is true and authentic, more than just a mere factual document. And of course here, a very good example of that. Once again, those sort of really factual elements that he brings in. Here's the dancer scratching her back, and a couple are gossiping and fixing her bodice. But then right in the middle, you have a big giant lie in the form of Jules Perrault. Jules Perrault was a renowned, he was one of the great giants of the Romantic era of ballet. The Paris Ballet sort of peaked in the 30s and 40s, and it was the greatest ballet company in the world, bar none. Over the course of the century, its reputation began to slide a bit. And Perrault was very successful as a dancer and as a choreographer. And in fact, in the 30s and 40s, he was the greatest male dancer on the stage. He was renowned. But he had a bit of a falling out with the administration of the Paris Opera. So he decided to sort of take his act on the road, and he traveled all around Europe performing and also choreographing ballets. One of the most famous ballets he choreographed, for example, was Giselle, one of the great white ballets. In fact, he even went on, he became the director of the Imperial Ballet in St. Petersburg, which was the ballet which was very much ascendant at that time, was growing in its fame and reputation as Paris was sort of losing some of its fame. In 1850, he goes back to Paris, hoping to mend bridges with the opera administration, but they were having none of it, and he effectively retires. So essentially, in Degas' painting, which you see from, which he begins in 1873, he's showing someone who hasn't even been associated with the Paris Opera in a quarter century at that point. And yet, he puts him in there, and people who knew him and recognized him would instinctively think back to the golden age of the Paris Opera. I mean, Degas' decision to include Perrault is very conscious, very intentional. And of course, he had met Perrault, and Perrault posed for him. There's a number of drawings and even a painting showing him. And even now, you can feel, even as an old man, that sense of power and strength. And you can see him with that that stick, which he would bang out the time. I mean, this, you're not going to mess around with him. He is a very imposing figure, even despite his age, because of his renown and his fame as a choreographer. Now, Degas, as I said, very much turned to the ballet. It greatly inspired him. But it wasn't just subject matter that really came out of this love affair. The opera ballet also really challenged him to think creatively and innovatively as an artist. He begins in the mid-1870s in particular to experiment with new media, new formats, new compositions. It's as if, you know, working with the opera subject matter, that then really sort of fired his creative energies, that he really sort of became fixated on new approaches. And of course, he uses new materials and new media and new approaches in all of his art, but it seems that every great experiment started at the opera. One example of that is, of course, his first monotype, which we have in the exhibition. It's a very large monotype of the ballet master. And also, FYI, there's Perrault again, just hanging out as he does. It's an extraordinary, strange work. A monotype, as you might guess from the name, is a print that's meant to be a single unique impression, and it is made by taking a copper plate or a glass plate, covering it with dark ink, and then you wipe away the places you want to be white, and then you put paper on it, you run it through a press, and you have a print. And of course, Degas being Degas, you know, petty things like, you know, the rules of art didn't apply to him. He would oftentimes pull a second impression, which would be much lighter and paler in tone, which he would then highlight and build up with pastel and gouache to create a new composition, which, in fact, he does in multiple cases. And so I encourage you, when you visit the exhibition, look closely at the credit line, and you'll see in the media line, oftentimes it will say pastel over monotype, which is when he, in fact, is doing this. But these are extraordinarily inventive days for Degas, and he's very creative. And so it's wonderful to see these works that are in monochrome. But I also want to encourage you to look very carefully. Remember, Degas is an artist who's all about process. And he leaves lots of interesting traces for the eagle-eyed viewer. For example, in the painting of the ballet rehearsal, here you see these phantom legs that he's literally just sort of tweaking as he goes along. And some of them just sort of are clearly there from an original version as he changed the position of the leg. Over here, he painted out a second subscriber. There are actually two men. I have now dubbed this man the Phantom of the Opera, by the way. That is who he is. The fact that we can see these details now, it's possible that this is because the pigment has actually gone transparent. Oil paint can, in fact, become increasingly transparent and thinned over time. So these pentimenti, these sort of errors, are sort of basically becoming more apparent, or they may have been visible all along. Degas was oftentimes very casual about those sorts of things. He would just leave those details. Again, he wasn't concerned about the final process. Once he changed the leg, he just kept moving on and didn't worry about what he had done and whether or not, you know, a random foot might offend someone's delicate sensibilities or not. And again, there's Monsieur Perrault. I just wanted to show him popping up in the monotype and, of course, in the painting. This is one of those pastel and gouache over monotype. And this is not, some might think, well, isn't he cheating? You know, he's kind of basically already got the composition there and, you know, it's laziness. It really isn't. It actually becomes a kind of exercise. And again, an experiment. What can he do? And so the black ink from the monotype actually is perfectly suited for the theater because it gives it a kind of rich, velvety quality. And then he can play up the lights of the stage and sort of contrast the darkness and the shadow with the sudden pulsing lights of the gaslight. And he loved playing with those light effects. You can see it very clearly in works such as The Dancer with the Bouquet here. And notice how her face is lit, her chest, her neck, and it gives her this sort of ghostly mask-like quality. This is from the gaslight sort of lighting up from below and capturing her and giving her this sort of strange visage. And here too, there's another ghost leg. He was clearly playing around with the position. Degas once commented, there's no art less spontaneous than mine. It's not entirely true, because we in fact see how he is working through compositions. Very much so in this case, and this is a work I really encourage you to look at closely. Initially, this was actually a much smaller piece of paper. And if you look closely, you can see all these seams. There's actually 5 pieces of paper. And instead of just starting over and making a new composition, he just kept adding, putting in pieces around and around until he got what he wanted. And it's very ad hoc. It's very, you know, very spontaneous, dare I say, what he is doing. He's just sort of feeling his way. So he might appear that he's thought everything through, but the reality is he actually is working on the fly. He's creating, and if it doesn't feel right, he'll change something, he'll add something, always working towards some kind of perfection that only he can see. Now, as I mentioned, one of the great glories of the Paris Opera was the ballet, and that was indeed a big draw for a lot of visitors. And of course, just you can see from contemporary caricatures, people were very aware that it was the ballet that was attracting a lot of viewers, particularly older men. You see in the caricature by Daumier, where the wife is quite put out and tells her husband if he doesn't put down his opera glasses, they are leaving early. And then, of course, over here, these gentlemen who are so gleeful watching this row of dancers as they move merrily across the stage. And my personal image I recently found is just basically a photograph of legs, just legs of the dancers. So, yes, it was all about a shapely calf. That was why many people came to see the Paris Opera, to see dancers and to see this. You know, and Degas, of course, is aware of this and very much takes advantage of it. But, of course, among those who enjoy taking advantage of this, speaking of that as segues, were the subscribers. Now, the subscribers were wealthy gentlemen whose annual subscription to the Paris Opera essentially became an all-access pass. As subscribers, they were allowed anywhere in the opera house. They could go into the wings, they could go behind stage, they could hang out in the foyer de la danse, which I'll talk about a little bit later. And so you begin to see them everywhere when you start looking, these sort of dark figures in their coats. One of my colleagues said they remind her of sharks. And they are a little creepy when you begin to realize that what you're seeing are these older men who are essentially cruising in and out of these spaces where all these young women were essentially working. And this was completely condoned and accepted by the administration. And it is, of course, something that now we're very uncomfortable with. It was read as perfectly normal at the time. And Degas in his images isn't judging. These are not social critiques, but he is showing you what it was like. If you walked on, you know, performance in the wings, this is what you would see. And again, this is something that most people weren't actually even thinking about. They weren't showing it, in fact, because it was so perfectly normal. But Degas draws our attention to that. And once you see this, once you see these men in their suits, you can't really unsee them. You realize they kind of are everywhere, sort of populating this space and, you know, creating this sometimes very uncomfortable and disconcerting vibe in many of these images. Now, of course, as I said, the other reason people went to the opera was to see and be seen. For women, of course, this was a particular challenge. Women were not allowed to sit in the stalls in the Paris Opera. This was as much from practicality as propriety because the seats were very narrow. And, you know, Second Empire dresses with those giant hoop skirts, you were not fitting in those seats. In fact, even men couldn't fit in those seats. So women were, you know, basically confined to the boxes. And this, of course, was good and bad because, of course, being in the boxes was more comfortable, but it also meant you were on constant display. And women felt very conscious of the fact that they were being watched. And in fact, at one point in 1861, the city administration wanted to impose the same policy at the Théâtre des Italiens. And the administrator pushed back for fear that if women were forced to sit in the boxes and would be obliged to dress more elegantly, more expensively, they might not attend. It would actually hurt the attendance. So he was able to sort of push that back. But in the Paris Opera, if you wanted to go and you were a woman, you had to sit in the boxes. And of course, you came arrayed in your most beautiful garb, your most beautiful jewels. And of course, you then became very much an object of spectatorship. In his short story, Judith, Eugène Scribe, who was a novelist and also a librettist, talks about how at one point a young, beautiful young woman walks in the box and how the whole artillery of opera glasses swiveled to look at her. And of course, all you could hear was this hush of, who is she? She's so beautiful. Who is she? Which you can see very much in this Grandville caricature, where literally the men have been basically turned into nothing but eyeballs as they all watch this beautiful woman in the boxes. And of course, contemporary artists were well aware of this. It's very much a common subject. And so you have painters like, you know, Auguste Renoir and Eva Gonzalez painting their own versions of the woman in the opera box. You will notice, however, in both paintings, the men are not looking at their companions. They're looking at someone else. So a cautionary tale, perhaps. So you have these women in their most beautiful attire, but their escorts have roving eyes and are perhaps looking at someone else in another box who may be their next, you know, romance. The one artist who takes this subject on and takes it in a very different direction, however, is Mary Cassatt, perhaps because she's American, perhaps because she's a woman. But she takes us into the box. You will notice in previous images, like the Gonzalez and the Renoir, we are viewing from below. We are looking into the box. In Cassatt's paintings, we are in the box. We are with these women. We are accompanied with them. And it's much more about their experience. Very famously, the painting In the Loge, where you see a man who is trained his glasses on her, she's having none of it. She is there for the performance. And so she is very sedately continuing her gaze. I personally feel very strongly that when Degas finally does take on the subject of the opera box, it is through Mary Cassatt's inspiration. He was the one who introduced her to the Impressionist group in 1879. And in fact, his very first opera box painting was done the next year, in 1880, which you see in the exhibition, A Study of an Opera Box. And again, you see in the image on the right, the theater box, how he also has taken that same vantage point that Mary Cassatt was exploring of being within the box and looking outward, being part of that experience rather than being the spectator rather than being the subject of spectatorship, which I think is a very important distinction that both Degas and Cassatt are playing with. And in this painting, it's wonderful because he's sort of merging the two worlds. I mean, this is an absolutely impossible angle. You could not see the dancers on the stage from the box quite like that. And so he sort of almost telescopes them together, brings them and collapses them into one world of performer and spectator in this image. And then, of course, in his first Loge painting, you have this woman very much, now we see her, we are coming from the outside, but Degas has deprived us of all the things we'd expect to see. We don't see her beautiful dress, her jewelry. We don't see her beautiful décolleté, we don't see her lovely cleavage. All we see is her face, and again, turned into this mask from the gaslights, turned sort of strange and haunting. And when he exhibited this in the Impressionist show in 1880, the critic Wiesmann commented how she is far above all the yapping mouths below. So it's very much, makes a very clear distinction of class, of social class, that she is someone who is above, literally and figuratively. And of course, the fact that she can hire a box is very much, it implies her social status. Now, we have a wonderful room, which I hope you'll spend a great deal of time in. It's my favorite room in the show, in which we explore Degas' fascination with unusual, unconventional formats, specifically the elongated painting in the fans. The elongated paintings are quite extraordinary. They are double square. That means they're literally twice as wide as they are tall. And it's an unusual format for an interior subject. You would expect this, and he does explore it also in equestrian subjects, but it makes sense. You're outdoors, it's panoramic, nature is open before you. But here you're in an interior, you're in a very compressed space. And it's, again, it's a very counterintuitive composition to take, but the paintings are quite extraordinary for what he does and how he sort of creates a sense of space by having figures in the foreground on one side who are much larger and then zooming back to much smaller figures. So on one level, your eye reads from left to right, you scan horizontally, but he's tricking you into looking on a diagonal at the same time by the way he positions and balances figures. So it's a very creative approach. And these paintings are very not necessarily one-offs. They do sort of relate to one another. They're variations on a theme. And you have certain elements like this double bass lying on the ground. And I personally think it's scandalous that a dancer is sitting on the double bass. That is no respect for a musical instrument. And then you also see this dancer fixing her bow, and you see her again, you see another painting. So you can see how the lexicon kind of remains consistent. Certain elements appear over and over again, but he's playing with them, how he positions them, where he positions them, creating this kind of almost sort of seesawing of visual effect. I mean, they're really unusual and inventive. And these are not experiments that were necessarily carried out in one brief burst of energy, but rather, not necessarily sustained, but he would return to them. And so here we have two paintings, very similar again in composition. It's largely the same room we see in both paintings, with little differences. But the one on top is from around 1880, and the one below is a good decade later. So clearly he's returning to these ideas. He's thinking about them, mulling them over, trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. There's about a dozen of these ballet pictures, and we have six in the show, so I do encourage you to spend time looking at them. I also encourage you to spend time looking at the fans, which are a personal favorite of mine. There was this emergence of interest in painted decorative fans in the second half of the 19th century, fueled in part by Japonisme, the arrival of Japanese art, which was shown quite extensively in the World's Fair in 1867. And so suddenly artists are really beginning to think about the fan format. And it's a difficult format, it's a challenging format. I'm showing you actually this caricature because it's talking about different kinds of fans. And one of them you can just barely see is the éventail tableau, the fan picture, painting. Again, this was something that a lot of artists, the avant-garde in particular, were intrigued by and challenged by. And so I'm just showing you a selection of fans by Degas' contemporaries, and there's many, many more. It's all more interesting because fan painting, at least certainly by the 1870s, when it really hits its sort of greatest stride, its peak, was considered women's art. You know, fans are for women. They are the ultimate female accessory. And fan painting was considered a woman's art. And so now you have all these male artists sort of co-opting it and creating their own takes on this. And of course, one of the greatest is Edgar Degas. Degas produced at least 27 fans that are recorded. Two of them are only known through contemporary records. We don't actually have any physical presence. He did two in 1868, 69, two in 1892, but the rest he does, and this very much is a burst of creative energy, around 1878, 79, when he was planning the Fourth Impressionist exhibition. And he, in fact, talked about wanting to have a room of fans in the 1879 show. In the end, he only exhibited five, and he was joined also by Pizarro and Raffaelli, who also exhibited fans. So his grand, you know, idea didn't quite take off, but it did result in an extraordinary group of fans. And what you will notice when you look at these works is not only, obviously, the range in the way they are now presented, which is very inventive and different. The first extant fan we have, the Spanish Dancers and Musicians, this was given actually as a gift to Berta Morisot, the painter Berta Morisot. And you can see that she obviously liked the fan so much, she hung it in her home and includes it in this painting. But this is also helpful because it gives you a sense of how these fans were displayed. These were not meant to be folded and put on sticks and used as actual physical fans. They were intended to be matted and framed like a picture and hung on the wall, especially, as that caricature would tell us, in the private spaces of women. They were meant to be for women's enjoyment. And it's not a coincidence that a number of Degas fans found their way into the possession of women. Beata Morisot, Mary Cassatt, the sculptor Marcello, also the wives of patrons of his. So he was clearly marketing these towards the female audience. And it's believed these may have been an attempt to be commercial, marketable items. It didn't quite work that way. He didn't actually sell many of these. And that may be why he sort of gave it up. But they are interesting in that regard. And they're interesting in terms of the media. What you will notice is, of course, the fan is a very difficult format. It's curved and it has a central void. Right in the middle, there's nothing. And so it really challenges him how to create the composition, how to do something interesting with it and dynamic with it. And so he plays with void and shape, as you see here in this fan below, where there's nothing on one side, and then a sort of flurry of dancers moving across. He plays with the materials, using ink and watercolor and pastel and charcoal. This wonderful fan, he literally shows very distinctly two worlds, the world behind the stage in black and white, and then when the dancers go on stage, suddenly color comes, life and energy comes with it. He also used not only paper, but he also worked on cotton and fabric and silk, and he also used metallic paints. Now, unfortunately, these metallic paints, contrary to what they might say, sometimes they say silver and gold, they were not silver and gold. They're actually more likely brass, zinc, lesser metals. As a consequence, they have oxidized over time, and so they have lost a lot of their shimmer. These would have absolutely sparkled and scintillated once upon a time. So the trick is, when you see one of the fans, like the beautiful one up top, in person, you need to bend down and look up at an angle. And when you do, you can see just that shimmer that was there. Just imagine how vibrant they once were. Now, unfortunately, they aren't. That did not last. But they are, again, extraordinary works, and I encourage you to look at all of them. We have 8 in the show, which, to my knowledge, is the largest group ever assembled. So it is a very rare treat to have them. Now, we have you're looking at this image right now, and you're thinking, what does this have to do with opera and ballet? Which is what everyone asked me about. We include in this show because it's interesting in terms of Degas' thought process about opera and ballet. This is one of his very early history paintings. When he first started out, he aspired to be a great history painter. That was what most artists in the 19th century aspired to do. It didn't work out. He abandons the painting, but in 1880, he decides to go back and rework it, and he plans to show it at the Impressionist exhibition, which, that's an interesting choice. He didn't do it in the end, but what it does do is it speaks to Degas' interest in the human body, but also the myth of, well, not the myth, but the story of the Spartans and how they trained, and it comes from Plutarch. And he talks about how the girls and boys trained together, but how things like exercise and dance were not entertainments. They were training. It was about honing the body, refining the body, turning it into the perfect instrument. And so in many ways, this painting is a kind of metaphor for the ballet rehearsal, of what the dancers put themselves through. It's also an early and now revisited experience of how do you display figures across a composition? How do you create balance, harmony, and dynamism with the human form? Degas was, of course, fascinated by the human form, and particularly drawing. He's one of the great draftsmen of the 19th century. And from a very early point, he begins to build a corpus of drawings in a variety of media. He uses graphite, which gives you very great precision and control. He uses charcoal, which gives you much more fluidity and expressiveness, pastel, ink. He uses colored papers. And he builds this body of images, which he will then use for a lot of different purposes. Some drawings simply exist to understand how the body works. Some, like this one on the left, for example, is actually a study related to a very specific painting. And these drawings will then become source material for decades to come. And he will return to these. And so when you're going through the exhibition, sometimes you'll see a dancer like, Didn't I see her before? Yes, you did. And you'll probably see her again. Over and over and over, Degas produced something like 1,500 works on the ballet. So take that into account. And then these wonderful drawings. And here we have two that are just variations on the dancer sort of raising her arms behind her neck. And in other ones, here we have one where literally he's showing a dancer in a position. I have a theory that if Degas stopped being an artist, he would have been an amazing ballet master because he had such an understanding of what was good form. And some of the drawings are annotated with what the position is. Here we know she's doing a plié, because he mentions it on that. He would sometimes say the arm is badly placed. I mean, he was very critical of these models. But these are annotations to remind himself as he's working, as he's creating these very beautiful drawings, which, again, will appear again and again. In his later years, he undertakes a very interesting approach to drawing. He starts sizing up, and he starts working on tracing paper with charcoal, which is a very unusual choice. Tracing paper is very smooth, so it has no grip. It doesn't actually hold sort of the dusty quality of pastel and charcoal. But what it does have is its transparency. And so he would create drawings, like the one on the left, create a drawing in charcoal, and then he would put a piece of tracing paper over top of it, trace those figures, and then add another. Or he'd subtract. And so he builds and builds and builds. Rather than taking one drawing, adding a third figure, and that previous version, that iteration is now lost forever, he can now retain these. And so he does this again and again in his later years. Again, part of it is just to sort of see how it works. Some drawings he builds up and actually adds in pastel and creates very elaborate compositions. A lot of them he doesn't. A lot of them just exist for his understanding and his own experience of creativity as he is going and sort of refining and honing his knowledge. Now, as I said, we're getting into the later years of Degas, and there are some very noticeable changes, large part fueled by his failing eyesight. Degas had always feared that he would go blind, and tragically, he largely did. By the last 15 years of his life, he wasn't producing art at all. His eyesight had deteriorated to such an extent. But in his latter years, particularly the 1890s, you see him sort of grappling with that loss of vision and that refusal to surrender. He does this in a couple of ways. He scales up. His work becomes incredibly large. And you'll see this in a room which has, I think, the wonderful poetic description of orgies of color. That's actually a quote from Julie Manet, Berthe Morisot's daughter who visited Degas. And she said she went to see his studio and saw these orgies of color. Was just dazzled. Color. Color is the watchword of Degas' late work. His colors are vibrant, intense, bold, oftentimes very strange and even maybe a little off-putting, oranges and greens and just electric. He also explores outlining, these strong black outlines that you see to define form. Away goes light and shadow and modeling, which you see that sort of wonderful sense of the modeling of form in three dimensions. And instead, you have flat planes of color, bold strokes, and then these black outlines to indicate where the arm is, where the legs are. And these are put, these are not guiding underneath, they're on top. So they're very bold objects. But you also see him working less and less in oil paint and more in pastel. And pastel, of course, in many ways is the perfect medium for Degas because it marries drawing with color. And it is very expressive, it's very immediate, and unlike oil paint, you don't have to wait for it to dry. So you can just keep working. And so we have two of these wonderful late pastels. Sadly, we do not have more because these late pastels are on tracing paper, which, as I mentioned, has no grip. So they are very, very fragile works. So they're very difficult to borrow. But we do have these two extraordinary works. And when you go see them, you'll be struck by the textural quality of them, how it sort of built up and impasted they are, pastel over top of layer over layer, and he's cross-hatching and he's scratching out. And so they're very physical, they're very three-dimensional, very sculptural, in a way earlier pastels you'll see in the show are not. And then, of course, I just have to show our great treasure, The Four Dancers, which is probably Degas' last ballet picture. It is, as I mentioned, it is big, it is imposing. The colors are rather lurid, but again, it gives that wonderful sense in these greens of sort of the sickly cast of the gaslight on the dancers' figures. And here in these late works, we are so far removed from reality. We are very much in the world of artifice. These are dreamscapes. They're fantastical. They don't exist in any reality. These haystacks in the background, possibly a nod to Claude Monet, the line gets blurred between stage set, imagination, reality. It all sort of merges into this beautiful, colorful whole. And actually, well, there, that's an early pastel, so you can see the difference I was talking about. In the last room of the exhibition, we wanted to talk a little bit about the life of the ballet dancer, which, of course, is a theme that runs through Degas' art. The life of the dancer was challenging, as you can imagine. Dancers as young as 7 would enter the École de Danse and would spend their entire childhoods training to become ballerinas. It's grueling, difficult work at a time when there was no health care. So if you hurt yourself and you could not attend, you'd be dismissed. So it was a very grueling, demanding life that these young women entered into. But it was one of the few pathways open to women of the lower classes. Many of the dance students, but not all, came from lower class backgrounds. They did not come from wealth. Oftentimes they were the sole support for their entire families. Because as you rose through the ranks, your pay would increase. Twice a year there was a dance examination, once to just confirm your skills, but the second time was for promotion. And a lot would ride on that because promotion through the ranks brought greater exposure, more time on stage, and of course, greater pay. So most dancers never left the corps. They were always one of the lower ranks. Occasionally they would rise up, but it was competitive and it was fierce. And then, of course, it had this whole world behind it, the dance foyer, which I've alluded to before, that room in the back, which one contemporary described it as the bower of choreographic bliss. I thought that was such an interesting way of phrasing it. This was where the subscribers could mingle with the dancers. This is where the dancers would go during intermission, between acts, while they were waiting to go on stage, while they're resting and warming up. It's a green room. That's where people are at any performance before they go on. And through the subscription, these gentlemen were allowed to come in into this area. And as you can see, and this is something that goes far back. This is part of the culture of the opera preceding the time of Degas working at the Paris Opera. And of course, it's shown with, you know, quite charmingly here. You have dancers and gentlemen talking together. Here, actually, you're celebrating this. You know, this is almost sort of, a kind of society portrait. You have Fanny Elsler, who was a very renowned dancer. Next to her is the poet Alfred de Musset. Just behind her is Véron, who was the director of the Paris Opera. But it was very much this place where the dancers interacted, willingly or not so willingly, with the subscribers. And I think this painting very clearly shows what it was like for these young dancers, these gentlemen. And it's oftentimes played, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, and it's very, very charming, and the women are clearly very happy to be there. And some were. Some women actually spoke very warmly of subscribers who acted as patrons, who actually helped promote their careers, helped them advance in the ranks, who provided financial support. Many of them were very kindly gentlemen, but many of them were not kindly gentlemen and had one thing in mind, and I think you definitely get a sense, you know, of what's going on here. And so this has actually become sort of the backdrop for a series of monotypes that Degas produces that are inspired by the writings of his friend Ludovic Halévy. Ludovic Halévy was a librettist, and he was actually kind of opera royalty. His uncle, Fromental Halévy, was a composer. He composed a number of operas, including L'Africaine and La Juive, both two famous operas that Degas greatly admired. And Halévy actually became a librettist and actually wrote the librettos for a number of famous operas, among them Carmen. Georges Bizet was his first cousin. He also wrote the libretto for Orpheus and the Underworld, among other things. And so he was very famous as a librettist, but he also wrote short stories. And among them were a series of short stories telling romantic misadventures of two ballet students, Pauline and Virginie Cardinal, which were published in the press and then were compiled into a book called The Cardinal Family. And these became the jumping off point for Degas, who produced some 80 monotypes inspired by the story. They're not straight illustrations. And they were, it was only after Degas' death, 32 of them were published in sort of a deluxe luxury edition of the Cardinal family. But here again, you see that subject of the world behind the stage with Madame Cardinal, who is the original stage mother, looking out for her daughter's interests. But you, again, you have these images like this one, where you see Pauline and Virginie conversing with admirers, but notice how they're penned in. They're sort of trapped by the circle of men who are all sort of fawning over them. And even here, where Virginie is being admired while the Marquis Cavalcanti, who was at that point her patron, is looking on, again, something a little creepy about all of this. And again, Degas not judging, there's no social commentary here, but you do get a sense that he understands what is going on. And Degas is the ultimate observer. He is capturing this world and recording it, but not necessarily making any kind of judgment call about it. And then, of course, we have our greatest treasure, the one and only, the little dancer aged 14. This is the only sculpture Degas ever exhibited during his lifetime. It's the largest, most ambitious, most complex sculpture that he ever produced. And it is a work that we know a great deal about, but we also know a great deal about the sitter, who was a young woman named Marie van Goten, who was of Belgian extraction, and her father, who was a tailor, and her mother was a laundress. They moved from Belgium to Paris for a better life, and all three daughters at one point passed through the world of the Paris Opera. And Marie, of course, was a dance student at the Paris Opera, and she posed for the sculpture by Degas. Her name was never attached to it during his lifetime. When it was shown in 1881, it caused a scandal. People were perplexed, they were horrified, they were outraged. They disparaged what they considered to be her ugliness, what they considered to be her low-class, immoral, amoral character. I mean, there was a lot of baggage attached, you know, to this sculpture. And of course, people didn't understand the fact that she's wearing a real hair wig and she's wearing an actual silk bodice and silk ballet slippers. I mean, it was absolutely perplexing on every level, and contemporaries did not understand it. Unfortunately, the story of Marie is one that we don't know a lot about. About a year after she posed, the sculpture was shown, she was dismissed from the Paris Opera due to lack of attendance. She was missing rehearsals, which, again, was a fireable offense, which is exactly what happened to her. And she also, according to contemporary accounts, was seen hanging out in rather low-life establishments, you know, cafe dives, which has led some to think that perhaps she was being prostituted by her mother, which is exactly what had happened with her older sister. We do not know. We do not know for a fact. All we do know is that she disappears from the record. We don't know anything about her after 1882 and her departure. And yet, we know who she is. We know her name. We know who she was because of the sculpture. Degas has imbued upon her a kind of immortality that few dancers can ever dream of. And this sculpture has now become one of the most beloved and most iconic sculptures in the world. When you ask people to name a sculpture, they'll say, you know, Michelangelo's David, they'll say Rodin's Thinker, The Kiss, and they'll say this, because she is known to us. And she is known because not only because of this wax sculpture, which is the one, the original, and the only, and you can only see it here, and I hope you will see it, but it's known through the bronze casts. There are at least 25 bronze casts of the little dancer in collections around the world. I'm only showing you the ones that I personally have seen. So, and you'll notice, for example, a lot of interesting tutu action going on here. In Omaha, they created a huge scandal when they created this new tutu. And it was in an exhibition, and the poor curator, when he, at the conference, all people wanted to talk about was that tutu, and it drove him crazy. But nevertheless, people know this. They've seen it. They're familiar with it. And so this sculpture and the work of Degas in general continue to inspire young dancers. They see this and they dream. We see them in the gallery standing there, you know, posing in fourth position, looking at the sculpture with her, you know, her gangly limbs and her knobby knees and her stockings, which are a little baggy around the knees. And, you know, clearly, you know, her sort of underfed, you know, youthful body. She's still very much, you know, prepubescent. She's not yet a woman, but it's just sort of just on that verge. And it's such a remarkable, striking image. And yet it continues to inspire. And I just love that, you know, she's found her way back into the Paris Opera probably not how she imagined, but it's in the middle of a wonderful display where you can buy goods inspired by her. And of course, in my opinion, the real key, you know you've made it in the world when someone reproduces you in Lego. So she has made her way to the future, and she has become this touchstone for generations. And so I'm so delighted that we're able to not only show this work, but also to show it in a new light and give you, hopefully, new insights and new understanding into the work of Edgar Degas and into the world of the Paris Opera that he cherished. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.